Thank you. Good morning. So I'm trying to tell you a little bit my thoughts and also some experimental work on this cognitive architecture that we put together to mix and combine things that could be said thinking analogous to thinking fast and slow in human beings. And with the idea to help AI systems to be better at reasoning. So first let me acknowledge all the people that are working on this project. I've been working for a few years already, because it's a very multidisciplinary group of people coming from computer science, AI, and even constraint programming and preferences, but also other areas of AI like machine learning, but also areas outside computer science like philosophy and cognitive science, as well as psychology, because Danny was an external collaborator until he passed away. And the idea is that this multidisciplinarity was really needed to link this thinking fast and slow theory of human decision making to what we then decided to do in AI. So if we talk about reasoning, maybe we should first decide what we mean by reasoning, and especially reasoning in AI. So the outline of the talk is first my ideas about reasoning, and especially reasoning in AI, what is happening right now in that area. Then a few introduction about what I mean by neurosymbolic AI, the thinking fast and slow in humans, and then how we decided to interpret that theory and translate it into an AI architecture, which is called SOFAI, for slow and fast AI. Two instances of the architecture used for planning and for grid navigation, and then a more sophisticated architecture where we generalize it recently, showing how it behaves on another problem, which is we started just experimenting on graph coloring. And then finally, if there is time, to understand how to use that architecture also to not just to have machines that can make decisions by themselves using these two modalities, but also they can support human decision making. So reasoning for me is a process. No? It's a process of thinking about something to be solved in a logical way in order to arrive to a conclusion. That's a definition that you can find. Another definition is drawing inferences of conclusion through the use of reason. That is a kind of recursive definition, but to me, reasoning is the process. I don't identify with reasoning only the result of the reasoning process. And and that makes a difference, because if you... So there are reasoning tasks for human beings where we use our reasoning capabilities when we devote all our attention. So we usually, it's called like system two kind of reasoning. For example, for complex arithmetic, possibly combined with learning from experience. But there are also tasks when we don't use our reasoning capabilities. So we use what would be called the system one capabilities, like face recognition, recognizing a friend, something we don't really use reasoning, but we do it with our intuition and reactive capabilities. So I call reasoners those systems, or humans, or AI, that actually follow the process of reasoning. And those, to me, are the reasoners. So they use a process of reasoning with rules, with logical axioms, with inferences, and so on. Those that can approximate the input-output relation of a reasoner, I would call them a reasoner approximators. So systems that can behave well in terms of the output of the reasoning process, but not necessarily follow the reasoning process. So I would distinguish between the two, because in one case, I really care about the process of reasoning and then the result, but mostly about the process. And in the other case, I care only about the output. So that's why reasoners usually do not need data to be performed. They just need the rules to do the inference and the process of reasoning, while reasoner simulators exploit data. They are data-driven because they learn from input-output relationship, examples of input-output, and then they try to perform well. So when you see many papers that ask this question, can machine learning system or large language model reason? There are many papers that start with that question, and many of those papers answer yes, many others answer no. So why is that? Not because some are wrong and some are right, they're both right, but it's just that they interpret this word reasoning in these two different ways. So somebody interprets them as the performing well on an input-output relationship of a reasoning process, and then they test on benchmarks, and then they say, ah, okay, can solve 80% of these problems well. So in that sense, they say, yes, it can do reasoning, but in my mind, that's a reasoning approximation, is not doing reasoning actually. And then others' papers, they say no, it cannot do reasoning, it's because it doesn't follow a reasoning process. So if you interpret reasoning in terms of the process, these systems are not reasoning, but can be very good approximators of the input-output relationship of a reasoner. Okay. With this, I don't want to say that having a reasoner is better than having a reasoner approximator or the opposite. Both of them can be useful in different scenarios. When you care 100% of having 100% correctness and consistency, then you should use a reasoner. And then you should try to help that reasoner possibly with contextual information that may come from LLMs or other machine learning systems, but you want to use a reasoner when you want 100% correctness and consistency, or even when you need to have a trace of how the output of the reasoner has been generated. But when you don't care how the output is generated, you just care that you have a good enough percentage of times that this output is correct, then you can also use a reasoner approximator. And the scenario of use is not that high risk that making mistakes may be a problem. Then again, something that is good enough that may make mistakes is okay. Not only they are not one better than another one, but they can also help each other, because again, the reasoner simulators can be incorrect, so they can be combined in a pipeline with reasoners that assure the correctness, and this is one of our approaches in the architecture. But also reasoners can be helped by reasoner approximators, because they can collect from data, they can learn from data some contextual information that can be useful in terms of heuristics or scoping the work of a formal reasoner. And this is the context in which we started, thinking about this using the thinking fast and slow, because in some sense reasoners are analogous to our thinking slow, and reasoner approximators are analogous to our thinking fast, learning from data. And so we started thinking about this in the context of the history of AI. They started with trying to implement in machines high level cognitive capabilities like reasoning, logic, and so on, and then moved to data-driven approaches, so mostly system one approaches. And now I think that there is an increasing recognition that the two need to be combined to really move forward in a way that is trustworthy, for example, in terms of the AI system. I think there is a lot of agreement that this is what we need, the combination of these two kinds of areas of AI. It's not really, there has been many, you know, people that have written papers, but also the AI 100 report talks about this trend that is welcome and supported, but there's not much agreement about how to do it. There are many different ways of combining these two areas of AI. So our idea was look at how humans combine these two different ways of making decisions and try to translate what we know, partial knowledge of what we know about how humans do it, and translate it into an AI architecture. Of course, in doing that translation, we had to make several assumptions, and also we had to make some decisions about not only that we have partial knowledge about how human doing, we have theory, but it's the theory, but also we struggled for a long time with the question is, okay, humans do it this way, but is this a bug or a feature? So do we do it this way because we are limited, we have limited memory, we have limited, you know, space, or we do it this way because it's the best way to do it, and then that's what we need to keep when translating into AI. So we struggled for a long time with that question, and at the end we made some very simple basic assumptions and design choices. So of course, looking at the human mind and the human brain, this is not new in AI. It was even at the beginning of the AI research history. But I think that now there is a better chance of succeeding. Also, our approach is not a neuroscience-based approach, so we don't look at the brain and try to translate how the brain works into AI, but we look at the mind, so theories of the mind, how the mind works, and we try to translate that into AI. So what is this thinking fast and slow, or system one, system two theory that was described in this book by Daniel Kahneman? So system one is what we use in our everyday decisions. That we do without even thinking about it, without being even conscious that we are making those decisions. So when we drive, when we recognize somebody, when we something falls and we catch it. So all these, you know, everyday decisions, very simple, cognitively very low, they don't need a lot of attention, but we use the system one. Usually it's much faster, almost unconscious. It doesn't use explicit knowledge. Sometimes we don't even know how to verbalize how we do these things. It can make mistakes, can have bias, prejudice, and so on. System two, instead, is something, a modality that we use when we really want to pay attention to what we're doing, either because it's very dangerous if we make a mistake, or because we feel that the problem needs our attention, otherwise we can solve it. So like complex arithmetic, unless you are, you know, a genius in mathematics, you know, complex arithmetic usually requires our full attention. So it's a conscious, deliberate method that effortful, and usually we use it for complex decisions or for decisions, for problems for which that are not familiar to us, that maybe later, with more familiarity, they get switched to the system one. But at the beginning, we use our system two to start trying to solve them. And usually with this full deliberation, usually it's more reliable. So system two is a kind of sequential thing. We do only one thing at a time with system two. And system one instead is more parallel. Okay, many things done by system one in parallel by even different regions of our brain. Again, so that's what I said. And again, there are these two main things. One is what I mentioned, the skill learning, meaning that at the beginning, even in some complex problems, we start using system two. And then when we get familiar with the problem, we use system one. For example, when we are kids and we learn how to read or how to write, at the beginning we, you know, oh, this shape means that this is the A or the B or a C and so on. But then we do it very without even thinking about it, the reading in our native language, for example. Not everything goes from system two to system one. For example, as I said, complex arithmetic always remains with our system two. It doesn't switch to system one, but many problems do. And this is sometimes called in that discipline is called skill learning, or you know, you internalize that skill. And the second one is cognitive control. So it's a behavior in which our system one reacts immediately to a request of doing something, but before we actually act, our system two can override. And because of values that otherwise would not be would not be followed by our system one, or because of some other considerations. So the system two can override and say, no, you want to eat that cake, but the doctor said you should not, so let's not eat it, okay? So cognitive control by system two. I have to say that Daniel Kahneman was also very interested in AI. In fact, he told me that if we had to were to become young again, he would have studied AI and not psychology, which I'm not sure it would have been, you know, a good thing, because studying psychology brought wonderful work to us. But he really believed, until few months before he passed away, that really AI still has not understood how to combine this intuition and reasoning in human beings. He was able to see the amazing capabilities of LLMs and current AI, but he still thought that they were mostly system one capabilities. Okay, so what we did is cognitive architecture. We said, okay, let's make it a very simple architecture that has so-called system one solvers that are mostly data-driven and do not reason about the problem that comes in and react, you know, as the problem comes in, they immediately respond to that problem with the possible candidate solution to that problem instance. And then you also have available, sometimes, not always, some system two solvers that instead knows how to reason about the problem, the kind of problem that you are considering, but they are only activated. They don't activate themselves independently. They are active. They need to be activated by whom? By another part of the architecture, which we call the metacognition engine. So that picture like that is very simple. So the problem instance comes in, it goes to the fast solvers, call it fast or system one solvers, they react, they generate a candidate solution. The candidate solution goes to the metacognition agent that decides whether that candidate solution is good enough or not. If it's good enough, fine, that's the final solution that will be generated. If it's not considered to be good enough, then the real-time metacognition will activate one of the S2 solvers. And then that S2 solver will generate the solution. That will be finally. There are models of course, repositories of all the decisions that the system has done, the models of self that contains every decision that the system has made, who made that decision, which solver, with what reward, and with what quality, and so on. So there are three kinds of metacognition, because one is the one that I just told you, the one that decides whether the candidate solution coming from S1 is good or not, and if it's not good, it calls S2. That's called the real-time metacognition. But there are also another kind, the reflective metacognition, that while the system is not solving new problem instances, it reflects upon the past decisions in a counterfactual way, and it compares the decision that have been made with the decision that would have been made if the system had used only S2. Okay? And then based on that comparison of the quality of these decisions, the one that have been made actually, and the one that would have been made if the system used only S2, may adjust the parameters inside the metacognition to steer the future more towards activating S2 or more towards activating S1. Okay? And then also another kind of metacognition is the one that updates these models. So updates the decisions, everything that has been done. The model of self, the world, and of others, if there are others. Okay? So the metacognition, the real-time metacognition, has actually two phases to make his decision. One is to only look at the candidate decision that comes from S1 and decides whether it's good enough or not. Okay, so only considering that candidate decision. Second phase, instead, it starts doing the pros and cons between accepting that candidate decision, if it's reasonably good, or activating S2. Because activating S2 usually may be estimated to give possibly a better decision, but of course activating S2 can be costly, while S1 has already done his work, so you don't need any cost in accepting that decision coming from S1. Okay? So the pros and cons between, is it better to accept this decision, which is good enough but not, you know, very high quality, or should I activate S2, which may give me a better decision, but then I also have to pay a cost of activating that solver. So, and there are many neurosymbolic approaches in AI right now and in the past few years. Some of them try to integrate very tightly the data-driven and the symbolic approaches in one single algorithm. Okay? This is not the approach that we take here. As you see, we keep the things very separate, although the S2 solver may have some heuristics, so it may have some pieces that resemble more S1 than S2, but overall is an S2 solver, is a reasoner. And but there are some that really integrate it much more tightly. That's not the approach here. There are others that keep them separate and combine them, but usually it's an ad hoc combination given the problem, kind of problems that the researchers wants to address. And usually that kind, the combination, the ad hoc combination, is decided by the researcher. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to use first the machine learning approach to do this, and then a pipeline with that, and so on. Here instead, we want to allow the machine, through this metacognitive agent, to make the decision by itself. Okay, how to combine, which one to use, and so on. So the expected behavior is that this architecture will give better decisions than using each one of the two kinds of solvers by itself, that would improve the decisions over time, that would be able to show this skill interlearning or skill internalization, meaning beginning using mostly S2 and then using mostly S1. And then also to show also the other thing which I mentioned, which is the cognitive control. The idea was also to leverage existing solvers. There are many existing solvers, and here they can be plugged in, and then they become a new solver, which possibly behaves better than each one of the ones that you plug in. And the last one is that we wanted it to adapt to the capabilities of the solvers. So even if some of the solvers that you plug in are not too competent, are not too good at producing solutions, then we would like the metacognition part to recognize that and to use it less, and so to keep high the quality of the decisions. So the first an incarnation of the architecture, so we use the architecture, it was on symbolic planning. This is the case of the blocks world, but we use many more, I think the six domains, the ones that you can find in the planning competition every year. And we use those test sets, those benchmarks. So here, basically, you have an initial state, a goal state, and you have some allowed actions with preconditions, postconditions, and you have to find a plan, so a sequence of actions that takes you to the goal state. So in this case, we used, as an S1 solver, we use an LLM fine-tuned for planning problems. We called it Plansformer. So we took an LLM already fine-tuned for code, which was code T5, I think, and we took it and we fine-tuned it over planning problems described in PDDL. Okay? That was our S1 solver. And S2 solver, instead, we use two existing state-of-the-art, I think, planners. One is FD, that uses the first search, and the other one is LPG, that uses local search. So two existing planners as S2 solvers. In terms of metacognition, we use just the real-time version, so check the plan that comes from the LLM, if it's good enough, okay? Otherwise, call the solver, the S2 solver. And so it has to include the metacognition, a plan validator, something that looks at the plan that comes from the LLM and evaluates that, the quality of that plan. So first of all, we went and we looked at how good LLMs are in generating plans, independently of whether you use it within SOFI architecture or not. And we saw that they are not very good. For example, they are not very good in terms of generalization. So if you take blocks word domain, if you change the names of the actions or the names of the blocks, then they compare to what you did for the fine tuning, then they make mistakes, you know, a lot of mistakes. So we did an analysis in that paper that is published at ICAPS this year of how much LLMs are good for generating plans. Our approach was this Plansformer that with fine tuning, we thought that it was the best way to get a reasonable system that could generate quality plans, but of course it still makes mistakes. So it cannot be considered as a full-fledged planner, because it's, first of all, because it doesn't do the reasoning part, but also because it not always is correct. And then we combine these things, no? So here we have the metacognition. As I said, it takes the LLM. So the LLM is what you see is called the PF, the Plansformer. So that's the percentage of valid plans out of 500 examples. Valid plans, so Plansformer has 80% of the time is correct. 77% of the time is returns optimal plans, and that's the third column, Plansformer by itself. Then we have FT and LPG, the two system two solvers, system two planners. FD is 90% correct because of course, it can be 100% correct if you give it enough time, but I think we give it a limit of, I don't remember, 60 seconds. So within that time limit, it was 90% correct. LPG is much faster, so it's 100% correct. But LPG is less good in terms of optimality, of course. So then you have the combinations in the SOFI architecture. So one is Plansformer, PS, and fast onward. And this is the column in the middle. So you see here that what it says is that can put together these two kinds of solvers. It can, oh my God, this is your son. It can solve 96% of the plans, 92% are correct. So all these combinations are showing that you can get actually better than each one of them alone. But it depends what you care about. Sometimes if you care about optimality, there are combinations that behaves better in terms of optimality. If you just care about having correct plans, but not necessarily optimal or shortest, then there are other combinations that are good for that. Okay, so the second incarnation of the architecture was to to generate trajectories over a constrained grid. So you have a grid like that, and in this grid you have constraints that when violated, they give you a penalty, and constraints over states, so it means that if you go in that state, you get the penalty, and constraints over moves. So if you move up, for example, wherever you are, you get a penalty if the move up. So here in this example of that grid, for example, the constraints are on moving left. You see there in the small, because there are eight possible moves. Now moving left or moving down to the right gives you a penalty. And also if you move to any green state and blue state, it gives you a penalty. Okay. So the goal is to start from a start place in the grid and to get to a goal state, which the system doesn't know where it is, with trajectories that are as short as possible, but also violate as little constraints as possible. So in this case, the S1 solver is just a reinforcement learning agent that learns on the past trajectories and their reward. And the S2 solver is an MDFT, is a complex algorithm, but is a deliberate algorithm that makes decisions based on various options and their preferences over the options. Now, no need to go into details. And the metacognition is both the real time, so choosing between accepting the S1 or the S2, and the reflective one. So every 25 problems that are solved, we stop, and the metacognition does this counterfactual comparison with what would have happened if it only used S2, and then possibly adjusts the internal parameters. We also generated not just one S1 solver, but five versions of that one S1 solver with different degrees of randomness, because we wanted to simulate S1 solvers that are not reliable, like 100% random or 75% random, no? Or to the other extreme, always really producing the move that is the best, is estimated to be the best. So while for planning, we use SOFI to generate a plan, an entire plan, given a planning problem, SOFI is called once and it generates the entire plan. Here instead, we use SOFI every time we have to generate a move. So it means that when you generate the full trajectory, some moves may have been made by the S1 solver and some other move by the S2 solver, you know, in the interleaving way. Okay? Every time the SOFI decides. So here you see that these are the three criteria that we decided to use to evaluate the behavior, the reward of a trajectory, which basically is the reward is the opposite of the penalty that you accumulate by violating the constraints, the time of the trajectory and the length of the to generate the trajectory and the length. So here the green one is SOFI and the blue one is the S2 solver. The S1 solver is very bad, doesn't even show it, we don't even show it here because otherwise the other two would be collapsed. So you see that SOFI has a comparable or better reward, less time, and a shorter trajectory. So by doing these combinations and leave it to the metacognition to decide which one of the two solvers should do the next move, then you can get trajectories that, according to these three criteria, are better. Also, SOFI can adapt to these five versions of the solvers. The S1 solver, as I said, there are five versions. To the left, which I think is completely random. To the right, which is the column of System 1 solvers that are completely, not completely deterministic, because it's non-deterministic, but we eliminate the randomness that we have introduced. So in all of them, SOFI is the orange one. You see that the length is less or equal, the reward is higher or equal, and the time is also less or equal. Independently of which one is of these five versions of S1 are chosen. So how does SOFI do that? It does that by deciding, modulating the percentage of times that it uses S1 compared to S2. So here it shows again, there are the five versions of the S1 solver. Here it shows the skill learning, and this is how SOFI does obtain those results that we saw earlier. And the skill learning, you see that S2 is the orange one, so at the beginning is mostly using S2, so the orange is on top. For some versions of the S1 solver, it keeps staying on top, like the one on the far left, because the S1 solver is not reliable enough, so it never goes into activating more, using more the S1 solver. But for some others, there is a switch where the orange, which is on top at the beginning, over time, the x-axis is the trajectories over time that are generated, over time goes down, and SOFI uses more of S1 instead of S2. Okay, so it does this skill learning similar to what we do when we become familiar with a problem. We also tested this other behavior, the cognitive control, with a parameter that tells SOFI that the problem is very serious, so it's very dangerous if you make a mistake in that problem. So this is called the risk aversion. And we see that when the risk aversion is highest, like 1 in that parameter, then SOFI can violate less constraints in the grid compared to when the risk aversion is low. Okay, so now let's have a look, another look at this architecture and try to generalize it. So what the architecture does, as I told you, it takes the candidate solution produced by the S1 solver, it evaluates that solution, and if that solution is considered to be good enough, then it returns that solution externally. Otherwise, it makes these pros and cons between should I keep it, that solution, or should I activate S2? And then if it decides that keep that S1, then it returns it. Otherwise, it activates S2, and then S2 solver will return the solution. This is what is happening in the basic SOFI architecture. So the way we generalize it, but this is not very satisfactory for various reasons. One of the reasons is that maybe what the S1 solver generates is not of good quality, but maybe with some help, with some feedback or some help, that S1 solver can generate a better solution. And in that case, you would avoid using the S2 solver, which usually is more costly, especially for problems that need search when you use a reasoner. So what we did is exactly in that way. So yes, the solution goes to the real-time metacognition, evaluates the solution. If it's good enough, finished, goes out. Otherwise, it looks at whether that solution can be improved with some feedback. And it decides how to respond to that and possibly calls again the S1 solver with feedback on where was the mistake, where was the low quality of that solution that was given by S1. And possibly using some examples of how to solve cheaper problems than the one that you are supposed to solve. And the solver that can help you is the S2 solver that can help you give the examples to the S1 solver with smaller problems so that the S1 solver can possibly solve better the problem distance that you are given. So you are introducing this loop, and especially works well when that one is an LLM-based S1 solver, because you can use this prompt even in natural language. And of course, you have to decide how many times you want to do that loop until you say, okay, at some point maybe it's not even worth anymore to do the loop, let's just call the S2 solver. So we started trying with that generalized architecture for a very simple graph coloring problem. So the S1 solver is an LLM, we use Mistral. The S2 solver is an algorithm that generates a not necessarily optimal coloring of a graph. And the metacognition, again, validates the color assignment generated by the LLM. And if it has mistakes, which assigns, you know, two colors to nodes that are connected by an edge, then it provides the feedback to the LLM. And the feedback can be, we evaluated various things. It can just say you're wrong, or it can also provide one of the mistakes, or it can provide all the mistakes, all the pairs of nodes where he made a mistake. Then you have also examples, and in this case, we chose very simple examples like a pair of nodes. You see, so examples saying, okay, if you have a pair of nodes and there is an edge, you have to give them different colors, and an example of that, or a triangle, or a four click. And then we decided that we wanted to do the loop at most 5 times, and then if thing was not correct, we would call the S2 solver. So we generated graphs, very small graph, up to 5 nodes, 100 graphs per experiment, combining also the feedback, the examples, and the graph sizes. So this is the prompt that we started giving to the LLM, this Mistral. So natural language, describing what we wanted from the LLM, and describing also the way we wanted the output, because we didn't want the output in natural language. The evaluator needs to have very, you know, structured output, so we wanted the output like name of the node, name of the color, and so on. So this is how you would tell, you know, an LLM in natural language that you wanted to solve a coloring problem. In this case, we gave him an upper bound to the number of colors to use. That upper bound was given to us by the S2 solver, because the S2 solver not necessarily is an optimized, I mean, it gives you the optimal solution, but at least it gives you an upper bound. If the S2 solver could do it with those number of colors, then the LLM should do it too. So that's how we generated this number of colors that you see here. So the response in this example, the response for all LLM is following what we said. So it's this one. So you have nodes R colored with color 1 and so on. No, this assignment of color to nodes. And then the validator is the one that decides, you know, whether the assignment is correct or not. And if it's not correct, in this case it's not correct, so it says the color is not correct and it gives the feedback. It also, in this case, decides to give examples, which in the form of a triangle. Okay, so that's the new prompt that we would give the LLM. And then again, until either we get a solution that is correct, or after 5 times we call the S2 solver. So we have a very simple system that generates this and lets you decide which kind of feedback, which kind of examples you want to upload a file describing the prompt. And this is an example, a demo of that, where here is the prompt given to the LLM. And then I think here is the return, the solution given by the LLM. Is also the demo also visualizes that solution, but it's not needed. It's just for us. It was simpler to see whether there were mistakes or not. And then the evaluator provides the new prompt, which says it's not correct. Now it generates another one. In this case, it's correct, so it finishes there. Okay. In this case, the graph was very simple. It was just a chain. So here you see the LLM in alone called just once, okay? So not within Sofi with all that loop, just once. Call the LLM and see how many solution, correct solution it gives you. And at most, in graph sizes from 5 to 9, at most it can solve 25% of the problems, so not very much. Okay? So here instead is a success rate when you embed the LLM in this architecture. So, of course, when you embed it in the architecture, you have a success rate of 100%, because if after 5 times the LLM does not produce the correct solution, you call the S2 solver and that provides you the solution. So this bar just shows you how many times of that 100% success rate, how many times the solution comes from the LLM instead of coming from the S2 solver. So here you see that it can be up to 60% of the time with this looping thing, the solution comes from the LLM. It goes down with the graph size growing up, but then it goes up again with graph size 9, and we investigated a little bit the reason for that, and the reason was that when the graph size goes up, you have more constraints, more edges. So what I'm going to say, I'm not sure is correct, and I'll tell you why, but anyway. So when the graph size goes up, you have more constraints, usually, because the way that these graphs and edges are generated. But also, you may have a higher number of colors that are available, because again, the number of colors is not the optimal one, is not the minimum one. So with the graph size 9, we saw that there were many graphs where the upper limit was 9, which means that you can choose any color in any way you like, because you have 9 colors. Of course, the fact that LLMs can solve less problems, even with the loop, when the graph size goes up, it's something that is not really, why should it be more difficult for the LLM? The LLM is not doing a search, it's not looking at the graph. Maybe, yes, it has more tokens to look at in the context, no, in the prompt, but it's not really doing really some search in the graph, no? So, but the experience here in this experimental shows that it makes it difficult from the LLM if you have more constraints and you don't augment the number of colors. Again, this is another way that we wanted to explore this, but it's basically the same thing that I said. We wanted to explore why we had that trend like that. We also tested which kind of feedback and which kind of examples were helping the LLM more in this loop. And so we saw that providing all mistakes as feedback, instead of just saying you're right or wrong, or saying this is one mistake that you did, is what helps the LLMs best. So you have to, you know, providing all mistakes, which will be the blue bar, it gives you a lower error rate than the other ones. And also, in terms of examples, the more complex are the examples, so the triangles or even the four clicks, the better it is for the LLM. So helping the LLM, you have to give more complex examples, larger examples, and to give all the feedback that you can give him in terms of the mistakes that he made. Which is kind of reasonable. I mean, I don't know if it's reasonable or not, because again, it's not clear to me how this feedback in the prompt is used by the LLM to produce the new solution. But that's what we saw. Also time. I don't know, time goes up a little bit on the LLM side. Why does it go up? Maybe again because there are more tokens to be looked at or to generate, but not because it does any search in that graph. But it goes up not as much as the S2 solver goes up, because of course with larger and larger graphs, then the S2 solver would be much more expensive, and we think that the LLM would more or less get the same stabilized. So the last thing that I wanted to mention is that we use this analogy of the thinking fast and slow in human beings, not only to generate a machine like the ones that I showed you, an architecture that could make decisions by itself using this combination of thinking fast and slow translated into AI, but we also thought about using that theory to create machines that can support human decision making. So we know that humans make decisions using this combination of thinking fast and slow, and in some context where the machine makes recommendation to the human being, it may be useful to nudge the human being towards using his or her S1 method, method of reasoning, or the S2 method. Sometimes people call it introducing friction. So, for example, if you think that you want the human to really evaluate the recommendation that comes to the machine, you have to push the human to think about that in some way, using some methodology, to stimulate the slow thinking of the human being. So introducing friction, making sure that the human does not just accept what comes from the machine without thinking about it. And so we use this concept of nudge, which is sometimes it's seen in a negative way, because nudge seems something that tries to manipulate you or convince you of something. But it's in behavioral economics is very used. And in fact, the concept, not in AI, but in behavioral economics, the concept of system one and system two nudges is very common. For example, the image on the cigarette pack, no, of the people with cancer in their lungs and so on. This is a typical example that they always give as a system one nudge. So here they want to stimulate your emotions, your reaction, right? While instead the nutrition label on when you buy something, it has nutrition label. That's called a system two nudge or an educational nudge. So a nudge that makes you think, and maybe makes you help make better decisions in the future when you buy something else that you consider, you know, the ingredients or the nutrition thing. So the same thing can be done also with the recommendation of AI, not in terms of what you actually are recommending, but when you are recommending something. So when there is a problem to be solved, a decision to be made, you can give it to the machine, and then you can decide how to when to give the nudge to the human being, and depending on this timing of the nudges, which can be before the human being sees the problem to be solved or after the human being sees the problem to be solved, you can stimulate the system one or the system two of the human being. So you have these five interaction. The two extremes are only humans and only machine, and the three in the middle are the AI nudges the human to use system one or system two, or even your metacognition, questioning about which one you may want to use. So there is an example there, for example, the AI that automatically adds the product to your shopping cart, that's a nudges to use system one, so you kind of, oh, it's okay for you that the human chooses what the AI has decided. The second one is stimulating the system two, so the machine does not put something in your shopping cart, but it gives you some alternatives to think about compared to what you have already in the cart. And then the last one is to nudge human to use metacognition. It doesn't give you alternatives, it asks you if you want to see alternatives, so it stimulates your metacognition instead of the system two. Okay, so we started with some analysis of this framework to see whether humans would accept these AI nudges or not, and whether they would be impactful, just like the studies that people did with human, not AI nudges. And so we are in the concept of doing that. But we think that definitely there is something to be done, especially when you want people to think carefully about accepting what comes from the AI system as a recommendation, like in healthcare or in decisions that could be very serious in the high-stake domain. So as a summary, this architecture combines these two kinds of solvers. So sometimes in the basic architecture, these two kinds of solvers are just alternative ways to solve the problem, one using a reasoner, the S2 solver, and the other one using a reasoner simulator, approximator, no, the S1 solver. But it could also be that these two solvers are not solving the same problem. The S2 solver could just provide examples to the S1, to helping the S1 solver. And the metacognition also can help the S1 solver again, providing this feedback, as we saw for the graph coloring. We are working also to help not only the S1 solver from the S2, but also in the opposite direction, so using the S1 solver to provide contextual information that sometimes is missing in an S2 reasoner, in S2 solver, to also use this... to show experiment with problems where using the S2 solver is really very costly because it requires really costly search. To use the S2 solver to generate examples that are simpler in terms of search and less costly than solving the whole problem instance that we have to solve. For example, in the blocks world planning domain, we may want to give to the S2 solver, to provide an example, the same problem that we have to solve, but where all the blocks are all on the table instead of stacked on top of each other, because in that case the problem becomes polynomial, whatever the goal state is, and then the S2 solver can give examples to be provided to S1. Overall, this architecture we are building in a way that is increasingly usable also by others, where people can plug existing S1 or S2 solver and solution evaluators and example generators, and then try, you know, how the behavior is. All the software is open source, but we want to make it more and more easy to use. So this is the website of the project where you find all the papers, all the workshops, all the activities of the code as well. And I'll stop here and welcome any question. There's a question there. Do we need...
Hi, thank you very much for that wonderful talk. So in the Plansformer work, did you train it just on the problem description and then the solution, or on solution traces of a solver?
In which
the Plansformer.
The Plansformer, yeah. Tell me again.
So did you train it to did you ask it to directly produce the output, or did you train it more like a chain of thought
no,
style?
No, just fine-tuned with the examples. Fine-tuned the code T5 LLM with the PDDL description of the domain and the planning problem and a plan. Okay, a correct plan, so not with the chain of thought.
Yeah, because like in this reasoning simulation, you can go pretty far actually in simulating small reasoning steps.
Yeah.
That can go.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe a more general question if I can follow up. So nowadays there's more work on going on to action models, so LLMs that can also do function calling. So do you see this metacognitive framework with LLMs that do function calling, for example, so more automatic interaction where different tools are used, including S2 solvers, other S1 solvers, and so forth?
I mean, yes, there is a big trend in this agentic AI, no, where you take an AI system and you connect it directly with tools, so it becomes an agent in the real world. I think that there is, in my view, it's fine in certain domains. In other domains, I would prefer to be careful in introducing some friction here and there. Like we said, even whether it's a human being or other systems that you want to use to introduce that friction, because I'm not sure that we are, with the current technology, at the level of trusting it to be agentic in very high-stake domains. I mean, that's my opinion. But.
Okay, thanks.
Zainab.
So when you provide feedback to S1 before passing to S2 with the mistakes, is it done by the human or is it done by another reasoning machine?
It's done by one module inside the metacognitive component. that's the module that. So you are you asking if that module is an S1 or S2?
No. Yeah. I mean, or is it a human or is it a system, first of all?
It's a system.
Yeah.
It's the system.
And
Yeah,
who analyzes and finds the mistake and tells S1 there's a mistake? Something like S2? Or?
No, the S1 and S2 solver, so that's what the design decision.
Yeah.
The governance is centralized, yeah. And it's only in the metacognitive component. The S1 and S2, they don't do anything about the government. They just solve the problems. The only kind of self-assessment is done by some S1 solvers, because some S1 solvers are machine learning agents and they return also the confidence level. So in some sense, they do this self-assessment of how confident they are that is the solution. But otherwise, the solvers are just solving the problem. The metacognition is the centralized governance.
And when you provide the feedback again, who generates that feedback?
The metacognition.
Yeah.
Oh. The evaluator inside the metacognition generates the mistakes, so finds the mistakes if the solution is not correct. It may even, in this case, it finds all the mistakes. In some other problem domains, maybe it finds one mistake, or so it decides what to find, and then uses that to generate next input.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Go to the pictures.
Yes.
Okay, so we have to assemble for the picture on the steps. Remember to vote for the posters and enjoy the coffee break. And thank Francesca again for a wonderful talk.
Thank you.